coaxial stub, I think it would only take a couple of dollars worth. Oh, I take it back. Depends on what frequency.
Repeater, time out.
It depends on what frequency we're operating at and how many feet. I keep forgetting about the fact that a Heliax, Andrew Heliax coaxial cable, air-wound coaxial cable, good for very high power level, very low loss. It is fairly expensive in dollars per foot. I happen to have rolls of it in my backyard, and I think it's cheap. If I had to go out and buy it brand new, I know it's expensive. But there are other kinds of coax that I could use, and maybe I'll use a much less expensive kind of coax, but run a parallel pair of them side by side, if you know what I mean. So there's various ways around this. Let's see what N2XJN wants to ask about this. Go right ahead, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN, yeah, I'm a little bit confused. In order to synthesize the coax that you described, you don't have to short it, I believe. You can keep it open, and you could have a pulse width with a certain number of nanoseconds, and the impedance would be always 50 ohm, and that would be charge line. And so, what do you think about that? And that is not shorted.
There's two complete different classes of stubs. Short circuit at the far end, open circuit at the far end. Each has its advantage. If I'm making a shortest possible length of stub as a capacitor, yes, I will use it open circuit, and I'll make the stub less than a quarter wavelength long. All of those lengths less than a quarter wavelength are capacitive. The amount of capacitance goes up as I make the length longer, open circuited. If I need an inductor and I want it to be as short as possible, I'm now going to be using less than quarter wavelength of coaxial cable with a short circuit that synthesizes an inductor. So far I've used less than quarter wavelength of stub. Short circuit is an inductor, open circuit is a capacitor. If I'm willing to make the stub longer than a quarter wavelength, it flips. Now an open circuit is an inductor, a short circuit is a capacitor. Again, it follows the exact same formula, which I can give you, where you can calculate exactly how many nanohenries or how many picofarads. So there's two completely different classes of stubs. There's a whole bunch of stubs used as open circuits, a whole bunch of stubs used as short circuits, depending on whether you need an inductor or whether you need a capacitor, and each has its advantages and disadvantages. So there are people who think that all stubs are short-circuited. There are people who think that all stubs are open-circuited. They're both wrong. There's multiple kinds. That's some of the information I think you need, Wes. Back to you, Wes.
I could calculate by the time of flight. We'll come to the same. So 450 ohm, 2 nanoseconds would be what, 12 inches. If I want 8 nanoseconds, and I calculate the wavelength by half wave or quarter of wave by time of flight, that would be what, 48 inches. In the reflected energy is parallel termination that. And it would be lower in value than 50 ohm, then I will get the opposite polarity of the incident waveform. But if it's going to be higher, then I'm going to have the same polarity as from N2XJN.
2FIU.
But the words you are using, I can tell you're thinking of a capacitor, a stub, in the time domain. Nanoseconds of length and time of flight. That's one way of calculating. From my point of view, there's a slightly easier way. For stubs that are short-circuited, a formula that tells you the amount of inductive reactants for a short-circuited stub, the formula equals X equals Z0 tan theta, X is the inductive reactance. I'm going to call it X sub L. X sub L equals Z0 tan theta. Z0 is the characteristic impedance of the coax that's making my stub. Theta is the electrical length in degrees at your frequency. Quarter wavelength is 90 degrees. Less than quarter wavelength is, say, 45 degrees. So you take 40. If I had a stub that's an eighth of a wavelength long, 45 degrees, take the tangent of 45 degrees, which I think is 1, and if I was using 50-ohm coaxial cable, that would be a 50-ohm inductor at that frequency. So an eighth wavelength of short-circuited stub made out of 50-ohm coaxial cable is a 50-ohm inductive reactance at that frequency. And I can now recalculate that into microhenries if you want. So doing it as a trigonometric formula, in my opinion, is easier than thinking of it in the time domain. But that's me. The time domain approach definitely works. It's a different set of mathematics. And hopefully they both come out with the same answer. George, KD2FIU, I wonder if you've ever used high power stubs. You got it, George, K2RIW.
Low power with the antenna I'm working now. It's 58 inches of window line antenna that I stubbed at the bottom 3.5 inches below, and 54 inches above that feed line. And I agree with you, Dick, but my question is, if we want to do this for higher frequencies, for lower frequencies, can we use this formula? And I'm following the formula you recommend. Can we use this formula with harmonics, the mathematical harmonics of the frequencies, if we want to use this for lower frequencies?
With care, the answer is yes. A short-circuited stub, let me think about this now, yes, less than a quarter wavelength long, the inductor reactance equals Z0 times tangent of theta. That's at the fundamental frequency. If I go to the second or third harmonic, the theta number changes. The number of degrees of length of that cable, if I'm using the second harmonic, the same length of cable that used to be 45 degrees electrical in length, the second harmonic is now 90 degrees. And therefore, let me think about that. It becomes an open circuit. So that stub I just designed for you, an eighth of a wavelength long, 45 degrees at the fundamental frequency, is 90 degrees at the second harmonic. At the second harmonic, that stub is an open circuit. Ain't that crazy? At the third harmonic, it's now back to... Third harmonic is going to be 3 times 45 degrees, which is, 130 degrees or something like that. So now it's going to become a capacitor. So you can calculate what your stub is going to do at each of the possible frequencies. Not very many people design a stub where they're intentionally putting multiple frequencies through it, but it can be done. If you're smart enough, you can use stubs within your multiplexing filter. So therefore, there's ways you could make a filter network that's having one pass, one transmission line going into this filter network at the top of the tower, and now coming out with multiple output connectors to the multiple antennas. Could you design that with stubs? The answer is yes. You've got to be a little bit careful, but I know it's doable. Somebody want to make a comment on this? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Going to make a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I think you're asking, can you connect the stubs to another one? By the way, you timed out because you didn't wait for the beep. Can I put multiple stubs in parallel or in series? In series, no. In general, you can't put them in series. Can you put them in parallel? In some cases, yes. But the nice thing about these stubs is that it is a way of synthesizing, in some cases, an extremely high-power capacitor. I mean, to try to find a capacitor that at the 100-watt level on a very small magnetic loop antenna to tolerate the voltage rise without arcing over, with a normal fixed capacitor, with normal method of construction of a capacitor, that's difficult. The right kind of a stub in that location can quite often do the job, and you'd be amazed how much power it can tolerate without arcing over, if you know what I mean. I think that's some of the information you guys are looking for. There's a lot more to this than first meets the eye. but with 5,000 kinds of antennas, in my opinion, if you have any doubt on that, you take a look at the latest issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Volasic. It's got something like 1,800 pages. It's got something like, I seem to remember, 82 chapters on just the general antenna types and lots of subtypes within each one. And if you take if you're a member of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE, and you look at each individual issue, and you look at all the extra patents in the back of that issue that have been filed in the last month or so on brand new antenna types, on the average month, I'm going to guess is, you know, there's 10 antennas being patented on the average month. So there's a lot of antennas in this world. There's a million ways of doing it. Almost any piece of conducting material at the right shape can make a capacitor, can make an antenna.
Repeater, time out.
If you allow me to cut slots underneath the paint of an automobile and cover it over with fiberglass and make it look like nothing is there, there's a zillion ways I can put antennas into the sheet metal of an automobile. You know, these are stealthy antennas that you'll never see. There's a zillion ways I can do that. That's just a for instance. There's a lot more ways beyond that. On law enforcement automobiles, if you want to, the side view mirror can be an antenna. The speaker on the back, underneath the rear window, that speaker can be a double ridge waveguide type of antenna. You would never believe, you would never see anything there, and yet there's an antenna there. There's a zillion ways of doing it if you're smart enough. Some of the military aircraft are doing some of these techniques. So, in your particular case, where you want to take a relatively simple antenna type and squeeze it into your apartment, I know it's possible, and you think the metallic objects nearby are going to stop you and you think you're going to create shadows. You'll be amazed how few shadows they create. You'll be amazed how little amount of detuning it creates. You'll be amazed how little bit of change in efficiency it makes, Bob. An awful lot of those objects in your antenna that your eye says are going to stop you from putting an antenna there, as long as they're not a good fraction of a wavelength in dimensions, they're completely transparent. The RF energy will just wrap around them and like they're not even there. KD2, November, Victor Bravo. KTU, back to you, Bob. A good set of questions. You're going to be asking more in the future, and that's very acceptable. You got it, Bob.
I have a question, Tom.
Thank you, Dick, and thank you, everybody. Yeah, I don't want to take too much more of the time. I think it's probably time for Roy, the Science Net. But, I think my bigger issue is that I'm pretty certain I have chicken wire in my walls. I mean, you know, this mesh wire, I'm basically probably in a Faraday cage. That's probably much more significant than the cabinet stuff. But the other thing is, I guess, quick question about the alpha loop, this is the other one that claims to be able to do 100 watts, and they have the caveat with proper adjusted mic gain. Then maybe that's just a normal caveat. The system will handle under what, you know, again, the thing about does not peak your meter, again, pardon my ignorance, but I'm not sure which meter that means, and that sounds like a reasonable caveat to you, right?
When it comes to the true RMS power coming out of a single sideband transmitter that's heating up some particular component, to rate that, you've got to be careful with the right kind of a meter. If I'm measuring the average current and the average voltage on the final tube of the transmitter that's putting out single sideband signal, average current and average voltage, if I'm running key down CW, I can easily calculate the power coming out. In the case of single sideband, what is the peak envelope power? The peak envelope power might arc over a capacitor. That's one that made a failure. The average of the peak envelope power creates the heating. And maybe you're not going to be heating it. So there are kinds of meters you can use on a single sideband transmitter that have a peak and hold function. And they really measure the peak envelope power. There are very few of those. Your Berg watt meter, in general, is measuring something very close to average power, not peak power. But still, if you know the method of operation of your particular power meter, and you make a measurement with it, and now you want to reinterpret that from average into peak. There are ways you can make ballpark guesses as to what the peak envelope power is going to be. Let me drop. I'm not sure, but I think with enough study of a certain kind of averaging power meter, the difference between the average power and the peak envelope power on typical single sideband transmission might be a 3-to-1 ratio. If my average reading power meter reads 50 watts while I'm talking in a normal manner into a sideband transmitter, my peak envelope power might be 150 watts. It's in that kind of a ballpark. There are ways of pinning this down. And of course, it's going to be a function of what kind of speech clipping I'm using and so on. There's other variables involved. But at least you can come up with a ballpark figure. It might be close to 3-to-1. I guarantee it's more than 2-to-1. I guarantee it's less than 5-to-1, if you know what I mean. So we can pin it down approximately. So what I think the manufacturer is telling you that you got to be careful with what kind of a meter you're using to measure the power, if that's what you're doing. You might not have to measure the power. The owner's manual on your particular transmitter may tell you what is the peak envelope power in the sideband transmitter mode when you set the controls in this particular manner. They're supposed to go over to West. Let me see. Let me turn it back to you, Bob, and see if that makes some sense. KD2NVB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Completely understand all the details of that. So it's not just the standard on the, like I have an ICOM 7100, but I'm sure all the radios have these. There's like SWR, obviously not SWR, but I mean there's some other meters on here. Or is it just like, maybe it's my power supply, but no, it's not that, that's amps, volts, never mind. I can check this stuff out. It may take you too long to completely get every detail straight in my mind to hold up the whole net.
Yeah, could I make a comment, K6DBZ?
Yeah, you're allowed to come back with these questions next week and ask them again, Bob. We're going to move on because we've been on that subject long enough. But you're allowed to come back and ask. You're asking a good set of questions. There are multiple guys out there who want to know what you want to know. Your situation is not unique. A hell of a lot of guys living in an apartment where they don't have very much volume, don't have very much room. They might have chicken wire in the wall like you got. And by the way, how much shielding you're getting from that chicken wire? Depending on how the individual slabs of chicken wire at the corners are connected together and folded and so on, that might not be anywhere near as much of a shield. You think you're in a shielded room. You might not be. There are ways you can take a very simple kind of antenna in the receiving mode inside of that room and listening to particular known signals, beacons and whatever, you can find out how much of that signal is getting through your walls. There's a 50-50 chance that the chicken wire walls are nowhere near as much of a shield as you think there are. And next week, if you want to, we'll discuss ways that you can make the measurement to find out how much shielding you're getting. Because of the law of reciprocity, let me drop.
Repeater, timeout.
Because of the law of reciprocity, how much shielding you're getting on transmitting is absolutely identical to the same amount of shielding you're getting on reception. So there are ways you can listen to standard signals, find out how much signal is getting into your room versus putting an antenna out the window and comparing it, so to speak. You can find out how much shielding you're getting, and you might be very pleasantly surprised. So the chicken wire might not be anywhere near as bad as you think. Wes, I think, has got a brief question, so let's find out. N2XJN, K2LAW.
And I want to make a few comments about that. I
have
a whole patent on antennas.
Okay, N2XGN. E2FI, you would help.
Okay, the question is, if you remember from FRAC or from even high power brighter equipment, the modulators, they were required to have a sharp rise time of narrow of pulses with fairly high voltage, 5, 6, 10 kilovolts. And they've been using something like a coaxial cable that was rolled like a pancake, and it was just one input to it. So it was based on the reflected wave. Do you recall this stuff, N2XGN?
Maybe it's the language barrier, but I do not understand your question, Wes, I'm sorry to say. Let me go over to George. He wants to say something. KD2FIU, K2IW, go ahead, George. Okay. I didn't understand that question. You want to try again, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW.
Okay, I have in front of me the old stuff from very much reputable British company Bournelia. Bournelia. It looks like a pancake which has only one end of the coaxial cable exposed. And you can, it doesn't even have a connector on it. You can simply connect the inner wire and the outside of it to the structure. And it is open circuit, so let me jump. Yeah, it says on it, pulse width 8 nanoseconds, impedance 50 ohm, and it's a charge line unit. So, I was asking you, do you recall such a stuff, which actually act like a capacitor from the time when you were dealing with radars, with modulators, or maybe something related to National Accelerated Lab, which is LAC. They use it to enter shift.
I think you're describing a fairly elaborate, very specialized piece of test equipment that maybe was being used by SLAC. And am I familiar with it? No, I'm not. Sorry to say, at first it sounded like you were describing some kind of a balloning device, but no, maybe it's an energy storage device, maybe it's part of a pulse-forming network, something that's being used by SLAC. I'm not familiar with what you're describing, Wes, I'm sorry to say. We've gone 2.5 hours. Normally, this section of the TechNet is only 1 hour long. We've gone way beyond cutting into the timing for both Roy and Paul, so we're very late. I'm going to switch over. You guys have asked some good questions. You've got a lot of enthusiasm, and you're allowed to re-ask these questions next week. So I know you haven't gotten very complete answers so far. Hang in there. There's a lot more. There's a lot more where that came from, if you know what I mean. We're now going to go over to the science section, and Roy, good luck squeezing everything you got into your section. And Roy likes participation. We've got a lot of participation on this particular section. Let's hope we have as much participation on the next one. AC2GS with the science talk, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
And to Rio.
Dick, you want to pick up Rich before I begin, if I ever begin?
No, I'm for the time being, I'm sorry, fellas. I'm cutting you off on the first section. We've gone for an hour and a half, correction, we've gone for 2.5 hours on what should have been a 1 hour section. We're way beyond, so I'm cutting you all guys off. I know that we don't have a life and death situation. Some of these questions will hold until next week. I'm sure glad you guys got enthusiasm, but there's a lot more than we normally have. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2LIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. Thank you. And also, thank you for mentioning the chat room, because we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, which is a lot of people for the chat room, and we were kind of holding our own little mini science report in the chat room, and I keep the text there, so if anyone's curious and just types in chat.ac2gs.com, it'll log them on, and they can read what we were discussing as far as physics. Once again, if you want to contact me, if you are interested in a topic, have a question, have an answer, have a disputation, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything that I talk about, I will be offering links to articles and YouTubes and such. And that page is roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a second, and then I'll tell you the first little story. Okay, I'd like to try something a little different tonight as far as the puzzle goes. I've always been fascinated by science, why the sky is blue, how life itself works, and one of my earliest interests was the field of chemistry. I mean, after all, life is just an incredibly complicated series of chemical reactions going on simultaneously in trillions of individual cells in each human body. Now, if you want to get a sense of this incredible complication of this thing that we call life, I've posted a link to a website that displays a very partial diagram of all the chemical processes that go on inside each and every one of your cells, and you can zoom into little bits and pieces of it of interest to find out the greater detail. So again, just go to my web link page, roy.ac2gs, and the link will be there. But we're not going to talk about biochemistry tonight. I thought we might throw around a relatively simple but a fundamental aspect of chemistry. Let me drop for a sec. Now, chemical reactions or simple phase changes are usually described as releasing heat into their environment, i.e. exothermic reactions, or absorbing heat from the environment, i.e. endothermic reactions. As an example, a burning fire is an exothermic reaction, but an evaporative cooling is an endothermic reaction. So my little puzzle for tonight, if you'll humor me, is whether water freezing into ice is an exothermic reaction or an endothermic reaction, or if you wish, a non-thermal reaction, just to cover all possible options. So does anyone have any thoughts on this matter?
I've got to answer.
Yes, Paul.
I'm not sure which words you use, but it's not much of a reaction at all. I would say just the removal of that heat is going to make a change from water to ice. It's 144 BTUs per pound. That's what you have to remove, and then that water will become ice. So is there a reaction going at all? I don't think there's any reaction. It's the removal of the heat that's freezing it. It's not like some kind of reaction a chemical reaction that's happening within the ice. That's my guess. Back to you.
K2CX.
K2RW's got a guess. Go ahead.
CX, I think. I missed the rest of his call sign. What's your comment?
Yes, how you doing? Name's Steve, Kilo 2 Charlie X-ray. It's not a reaction at all. It's a change of state.
That chemical reactions or phase changes. This is a phase change, but phase changes can also be exothermic or endothermic.
Well, I mean, there is nothing. There would be nothing. Of course, the transformation of phase of water to ice is unusual in the sense of densities and the temperature at which the density of water is its heaviest, and the reason why the fish don't freeze in the lake in the wintertime. But I don't know where you're trying to go with that. There is no true reaction going on. Obviously, for it to freeze, it has to lose heat. But it's not a reaction, per se.
I say it's a reaction. Go ahead, Roy.
Again, we're going to get stuck on semantics. I accept the definition of a phase change. As far as phase changes, again, can be exothermic or endothermic. I think Eric wanted to make a comment.
Casey.
No, I was going with the change in state. It still requires a change of energy. Either the energy has to be generated internally, or it has to be supplied externally. And that goes for either heating up and changing the phase state, or it's cooling down. At least that's my thought.
Eric, which direction is the energy flowing?
KC1SAM.
Now, my thinking in this particular example is that it's external. You have a steady state, things being a phase of a steady state at one temperature, and then a change in temperature would have to be an externally provided change to something that's in a constant state.
His question is, which direction is the energy flowing? Then we'll go over to Sam. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, so the energy is flowing. If you want to talk about the thermal dynamics of it, you're going from a more active state to a less active state, so therefore you're taking energy away from what was in a constant state.
Which direction is the energy flowing?
Outward. Okay, so it would be exothermic.
So you're saying the energy is flowing from the water to the outside environment. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying the forces here are outside of the water itself. Look, when you have a chemical reaction, let's say you take water and glycerin, glycerin and potassium permanganate, you are generating energy, and that's an endothermic reaction, and it's a pretty one, actually. But in this case, we're talking about something that's being changed externally rather than internally.
It has an external causative agent, but energy is flowing in a particular direction. We don't think that way, but I think that's what he's getting at. Sam, give us your answer.
It's an exothermic phase change.
I say give that man a cigar. What do you think, Roy?
I would agree with you, Dick. Sam, you got it right. Chemistry is a wondrous thing. People don't really think in terms of water freezing into ice as being exothermic and releasing heat. But really, that's what's going on. It's a conceptual problem, I think. But ultimately, if you, a lot of the people gave the answer as they went on and on and on. So it's a leap of understanding because it doesn't quite sound right the first time you say it to yourself, that freezing water into ice doesn't make things hotter, but it does. It's an exothermic reaction, and Sam is right, and I'm sure Dick knew as well. And Eric knew, but he didn't really feel comfortable with it, I got the sense.
Yeah, the energy inside that water, those water molecules are moving around at a certain rate. They've got a certain amount of kinetic energy, is my way of looking at it. It's not very accurate, but it's close. And the physical motion of those water molecules in the liquid state must give up that energy to the outside world when they slow down and go to a solid form called ice, where they're not long... They're not moving anywhere near as much anymore. They're now vibrating in space. They now become a matrix, so to speak. So energy must flow from the water toward the outside universe in order for that water to be converted from the liquid form to the solid form called ice. Therefore, although we don't consider it a reaction, it really is, from one point of view, an exothermic reaction. I think that's what Roy is saying. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick, exactly. Now, follow me if you will, and I think this flipping it on its side will make it incredibly more obvious and understandable. Just take it in the exact opposite direction. You take an ice cube, you put it in a glass of water. Is that exothermic? Is it giving off heat, or is that endothermic, absorbing heat?
Great answer.
Come on. You put an ice cube in water. Does it get warmer?
It gets colder.
It gets colder. Ice melting is an endothermic phase change reaction. So the opposite, if you take the little arrows and twist them 180 degrees, you get the exact opposite reaction. So I would think that ice melting in a glass of water being endothermic is a lot easier to kind of conceptually jump to than possibly water freezing into ice being exothermic, although they're just two sides of the same exact coin.
UFIU.
There's one other word we've got to put in here. If you're considering yourself sitting inside of the block of ice, from the point of view of the ice, you must apply heat to it to make it convert from ice to the liquid form. So from the point of view, the ice has to be heated, and it's endothermic. From the point of view of the water, you get the opposite answer. Over to you, George.
Roy, I think the way I remember this is, because it doesn't happen precisely at the temperature Fahrenheit or centigrade that we know. The actual physical conversion happens, and I might be wrong, at 8/10 above and 8/10 below. And that's how I remember what you're saying.
Yeah, the way I was taught that is that 1 gram of ice requires 80 calories per gram to be converted from ice to liquid. You have to apply 80 calories of heat to the ice cube for each gram of it to convert it from solid ice to liquid. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, if you Google phase change chart, you see this lovely diagram where things are in a solid phase and a liquid phase and a gaseous phase as a function of both the pressure and the temperature, because it's not purely a temperature-based phase change. It's also dependent upon pressure. And that's why if you live in Colorado with a high elevation, your water boils at a lower temperature than it does here in Brooklyn. So you got to keep that in mind. But yes, I mean, the heat of vaporization, the heat of liquefaction, the heat of ice, all those things are the actual bread and butter of thermodynamics of what's going on. This is just kind of the icing on the cake, that things are mostly exo or endothermic. Things shift temperatures. And I just wanted to point out a relatively common thing going on that we sort of take for granted and don't really like to think about, because for some odd reason, one direction of that reaction makes a lot of sense to most people, and the opposite reaction, not so much. Yeah, I couldn't make out that call sign, but comment away.
Explanation.
This is N2RQ.
Hey, the guy who said explanation and then Lou.
No, I was just thinking about if I have it, about KD2PBF, about water boiling. It has to do with the atmosphere, right, or elevation?
It has to do with the pressure of the atmosphere around it in equilibrium with...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's how a pressure cooker works. A pressure cooker causes the internal pressure in the device to go up, so that now water is boiling at a higher temperature and you're getting more cooking out of it.
Hey, Roger, KD2PBF, I'm just going to say perfect explanation, and couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you.
Hey, N2RQ.
Good evening, Roy, everyone else. A side piece to this description, which I think touches on George's comment before. When I used to do measurements of the phase change, what you find is when you're freezing a substance, such as water, it doesn't crystallize immediately at zero Celsius. It overshoots. You end up with it supercooled before it crystallizes. And the same thing with going the other way. It is a rather amazing thing to see. But the general idea of the thermodynamics that you've described in terms of endo and exothermic process is 100% correct. But I thought that other piece is rather interesting, because when you graph it, when you're freezing, it overshoots, and you end up with a dip at that freezing point. I think it has to do with the process of crystallization, that it takes a little bit more to get things organized. Back to you, and to our cue.
Yeah, and in some ways I think of that as a kind of a thermodynamic version of a hysteresis loop, that there's that little kind of strange little space in the middle. You can narrow that also if you introduce seed crystals and give it a lot of very small points to start crystallizing. You could bring down the gap in the in the supersaturation, the supercooling of a liquid. But yeah, there's that little interesting aspect also to phase changes, that they don't all happen at the same exact time. You know, nothing happens instantly, so it takes for every reaction. So yes, I agree.
What makes East Jersey Square?
Excuse me, Wesley?
Two questions. One, what makes hysteresis square? Second question, you have air, you have ice, and you have water. In example, they should describe what is the relation of air to ice.
Okay, I'm not quite sure if you really mean air. You might mean air. Usually it's water vapor, liquid water and solid ice water in a phase change diagram. But the pressure of the atmosphere on substances does distort their melting point and freezing point and such. And you can see that again. You just pull up any phase change chart, and there's two axes, not one. There's temperature and there's pressure.
If you were to describe endothermic or exothermic, what is the relation between air and ice?
Again, I don't quite understand the question. Ice and air can have the exact same temperature, so they could be in equilibrium with each other. There's nothing stopping them from being in equilibrium. Atmospheric nitrogen and oxygen can be at the exact same 0 degree and below temperature that ice exists. So I'm not quite sure what you're getting at.
The perfect answer. Now, another question was, what makes hysteresis square?
He may be talking about sublimation when it comes to ice and air, Roy.
Hey, I don't think so, because again, then that would be water vapor, not really air, but might be. I'm not quite sure what you mean by what makes hysteresis square. Hysteresis is a quality of magnetic material, of how easily it loses the magnetic polarization. Permanent magnets don't just easily drop their magnetism, whereas, as I talked a couple of a month or two ago, soft ferrites very easily dissipate their magnetic fields, and so have a very small hysteresis loop, and that's why they're used for transformers and for RF chokes and such. So I think that's the question, and that would be the answer.
Yeah, the question was, you got the question right. The answer, I have a problem with it. Do you remember from 1960s the magnets that were acting as 1-0 logic of square hysteresis? Enter exit.
Again, I'm not exactly sure. I think you're talking about computer memory before the wonderful time that we had solid state. And even before we had regular magnetic media, we had core logic, and that was little toroids and wound pieces of wire and sensing wire and such. Is that what you're alluding to?
That is correct.
Okay, well, yes, they use the concept of hysteresis loss to actually operate those devices, and they could wire them in such interesting ways that they could actually build logic gates out of very small magnets, just by knowing exactly what kind of hysteresis characteristic it has and winding it accordingly. There's a couple of nice YouTubes on that subject.
Well, you just said that magnets don't really easily lose their polarity.
Hard ferrites, neodymium, have a big hysteresis gap, and soft ferrites have a very narrow, so it depends on the material at hand.
Yeah, get as far as you see in the computer memory in 1960 were square hysteresis, very wide, very nice square hysteresis magnets, and they simply flipped. And they didn't have a problem to flip, and they had a memory of it. So actually memory of it in the structure of the material is what determines square hysteresis. And to actually...
It's sort of potato-potato. You could say it's the remnants, which is an actual quality, which is basically what you're saying. That's the difference between a soft ferrite and a hard ferrite. You could say coercivity, which is related to remnants. So, yeah, there's different ways of saying the same thing, but some magnetic material has either more of a memory or more of a kind of magnetic inertia, if you will, than other materials like soft ferrites.
Yeah, I mean, I was really amazed. You have a magnet and you just flip it, and it forgets. It simply forgets. It doesn't remember anything that would happen. It just remained in the state that was left. And then you take out the voltage of it, it remembers. And that's what square hysteresis is. And to actually...
Okay, Wes, I mean, there are a lot of binary things that sort of do that. Electron spins. There's something called spintronics that engineers and scientists and physicists have been trying to shrink down and to use as solid-state logic. That uses the spin state of electrons. So there's a lot of binary type of characteristics in physics that are used, and magnetic hysteresis is one of them.
Yeah, thank you very much for your explanation. Go forward.
Thank you, Wes. I'll give you one more short one, and because I don't want to ruin the space report. We live in curious times when the public is cautioned not to swallow Tide detergent pods. In that vein, is another caution from one of our government agencies. This holiday season, the Food and Drug Administration has issued an important, somewhat not obvious piece of advice to the public. Please don't eat or use glitter in your baked goods unless it's clearly labeled as edible. The FDA's advice came courtesy of a consumer update sent out this past Friday morning. The update featured a short video showcasing an admittedly delicious-looking cake covered in non-edible glitter. Now, the FDA wants you to be aware that some decorative glitters and dusts promoted for use on food may, in fact, contain material that should not be eaten, the agency said. But consumers need to be aware that these materials may contain substances that should not be eaten. Amazingly, it's not the first time the FDA has felt obligated to step in and tell people to put down that forkful of glitter. In November, the agency sent out a warning about this trend, which itself was an update to a similar warning released in 2016. The origin of this mess seems to be tied to in recent years of celebrity bakers, cooking shows, and restaurants using decorative glitter on their cakes and other treats. Let me drop for a second. Luckily, for those hoping to reenact their preschool days, there are lots of sparkly products that are perfectly safe to eat. According to the agency, these usually spell out on their label that they are edible or contain ingredients like sugar or gum arabic or maltodextrin, cornstarch, and color additives specifically approved for food use. Glitters with no list of ingredients or with labels that only say they're non-toxic or decorative probably are not the kind of to eat. Don't eat these, please. If you're not eating bedazzled baked goods you made yourself, the agency added, you should ask your baker or cake maker about the glitter that they're using. Commercial bakers, meanwhile, should always remember it's their responsibility as a food manufacturer to produce food that complies with the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and applicable FDA regulations. The FDA said, adding that manufacturers of food containing unsafe ingredients are potentially subject to FDA enforcement actions to keep unsafe products out of the marketplace. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
This is something that happened to me about 8 or 9 years ago. I knew somebody, and I was in their kitchen, and they had a bottle of these sparkles that said were for cupcakes, and they were silvery. And I just happened to have my ohm meter in Leeds with it, and I put my ohm meter on a low ohm scale and just stuck the probes in the bottle and got continuity. And yet this stuff said it was for use on cupcakes. It was like the little sparkles and stuff that you see on cupcakes. So it obviously was metallic, but yet it said it was for consumption. Go ahead.
Net.
Okay, I mean, I can't imagine what would be incredibly safe that would be conductive. I mean, probably gold is very inert. I don't think gold causes human beings any problems, but that would be very expensive glitter. So most likely the stuff that they put on there is probably not a good thing to have in your stomach as well.
Yes, definitely.
I think I've heard of people who will drink a fluid that contains flakes of silver. Boy, that doesn't sound safe.
They have a, K2CX, they have a beverage that comes from over the bar. Gold Slater, I think, and it has gold leaf in it.
Yeah, the gold is safe because gold doesn't react. It's not going to give you any problems. We had a gentleman only, I think, a week or two ago who was into silver, using it as a bacteriostatic and occasionally swallowing it, and that has side effects among some people. If you Google that, they turn blue. They look sort of like Smurfs. So I would not suggest that you consume silver. It can have side effects. Anyway, this has been a very short version of the science report. Once again, if you have any questions, if you have any topics you want me to cover, we had a couple of nice, interesting questions on the Echo Link that we discussed there, but we didn't have time to discuss it here. But the mailbag at ac2gs.com is the best way to contact me. To see the links, I guess only one or two, is roy.ac2gs.com. And again, if you want to hang out in the chat while I'm not talking, we can do that too. Just point your browser to chat.ac2gs.com. So that's it for me tonight, but I'm sure you'll hear from me again. So on to Paul with the space report.
A quick silly question. People were gathering with simultaneous conversations on the chat room. With the Echo Link, the wording you used led me to believe that there are people chiming, getting together on Echo Link and having a conversation. I don't think that's what I should interpret. Is that true, Roy?
Well, at times they do, and they can, because there is a text box. Some people who use Echo Link don't use the text box. Some, I guess, don't know that there is a text box. But I've had conversations on the Echo Link application as well as on the chat room application.
Impressive. All this digital stuff. Something new every day. Ain't new to you guys, but it's new to me. Thank you, Roy. Exciting stuff. And I wish we had the time to go a little bit further with that change of state. When you climb out of a shower and you're not completely dry and you feel cold, and is that an exothermic or an endothermic reaction? What's really happening? Why do you feel cold? Next week, I think we should go into that. There's something to be learned there. Good stuff. Paul, what are these crazy space people doing this week? I'm Paul, WS2N with the Space Report, K2RAW in the TechNet.
This is WS2N with the space portion of the TechNet. And maybe Roy wants to stick around. I don't know if I have all that much here. But I know he always does. He always fill in at the end. Yeah, many different things happening, mostly with the manned space flight. You now have 6 people on board the International Space Station. Just recently you had another woman, American, go up there, Anne McLean, Russian commander, and another fellow from Canada. That would be considered at Expedition 58-59. And another one, 59-60, will be going up this February, end of February, February 28th. And that's going to have two Americans on board. Have Nick Haig. He just went up in October. He was part of the crew that had an abort. They were trying to go up in the Soyuz spacecraft to the ISS, and they never made it. And along with the commander, Alexei Ovechkin, from Russia, they both are getting another shot this coming February. Originally, they were just going up, the two of them. Now they have a third person, Christina Koch, another woman that will be joining the ISS. It's an interesting person. She spent a lot of time down in Antarctica, so she's going to be used to, when I say Antarctica, the South Pole itself, you know, we get stranded there and you have no communication for, 8 months of the year. I saw an interview with that astronaut, and fascinating stories. But, you've got six people up there coming this week. This Thursday, you have three people coming down. German Alexander Gerst, he was a ham, KG-5, TMT, as well as, KF-5-ONO, and then KG-5, TMT, which was Serena Chancellor. She's coming down as well with the Russians. So they'll be going back to three people. Just for a couple months until the end of February. The other crew goes up, and then we back up to six. So that's pretty good. A couple of satellites I just want to talk about real quick. OSCA satellites. They have one called OSCA 97. It's called a... they had another name for it. Came out of Jordan. It's JY1. They use the Jordan's original call letters. That was launched by SpaceX from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And that satellite, from what I understand, is operational. And then there's another one that went up with the same group from Edwards Air Force Base that started working, but then eventually it failed. Called the Fox 1. Official name is amateur OSCA satellite AO-95. And that one eventually failed. But that was part of the group. They had about 64 satellites at one time on a Falcon 9 rocket in California. So that was the most satellites ever launched from this country. Actually, India has a speed. They launched a rocket with 104 satellites in one shot a few years back. So... That's the way things are going. You have a lot of these CubeSats and like that going up, dropping. Last night, really this morning, 1:15 this morning, you had a rocket go up from New Zealand called the Electron rocket, built by Rocket Lab. Another billionaire, this guy Peter Beck, owns that company. And I think this is his third successful operational launch. This time he did a contract for NASA. NASA put 10 small satellites, CubeSats, on board. And then he had three others from another group. So he had 13 satellites to launch, and that went up successfully at 1:15 this morning. Took about an hour to release all those satellites to its proper orbit. Roughly a polar orbit, I think it was 87 degrees inclination. That's the way to go. I don't know if anybody heard the news about Voyager 2, leaving the heliosphere. A few years back, I think in 2012, Voyager 1 left the solar system or the heliosphere. This one was too far behind, and just I think last week, a few days ago anyway, still received signals from these spacecraft that were launched back in 1977, still going, way beyond like Pluto, like 3 or 4 times the distance of Pluto, to give you an idea. At the speed of light, signals from Voyager takes 19 hours, just one way to get back to Earth. So that's an amazing thought.